Welcome to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch by interviewing authors, discussing their books, learning about the writing process, and even, on occasion, chatting live with a panel of authors to discuss topics relevant to both readers and writers. My guest today on the Online for Authors podcast is Gary Simmons, author of the book Death's Pale Flag. Gary is a highly experienced neurosurgeon and a professor, and now an author. In my book review, I stated that Death's Pale Flag is a psychological thriller that had me from page one. The main character, Ryan, is a brain surgeon, so some of the medical stuff really hit home with me as my husband and I navigate his brain cancer diagnosis. However, I found what Ryan does as a trauma neurosurgeon amazing, and because the author is a neurosurgeon, it is very accurate. But the story isn't about a run-of-the-mill neurosurgeon and his patients. Instead, it is about a highly educated man who begins to see ghosts, some from long ago and some far more recent. Why are they contacting him? What will his coworkers and family think? Are they real, or is he cracking up? I loved this story and was sad to see it end. Gary did a magnificent job with character development. Definitely a must read, even if psychological thriller is not usually on your TBR. Welcome to Online for Authors. Today I am speaking to Gary Simmons, author of Death's Pale Flag. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's an honor. Thanks.
I'm really excited to have you here. I really enjoyed your book. But before we get started, let's give everyone who's listening just a quick elevator pitch. What is your book about?
Well, it's about a brain surgeon who's a bit on the overworked side, who begins to see things that he shouldn't be seeing. He thinks they're hallucinations originally, and then starts to convince himself that they're actually ghosts.
Okay. And that can lead to a lot of crazy places when it's someone who's supposed to be a neurosurgeon who is, you know, operating on everybody else, right?
Yes, it starts to make his work and his marriage come unraveled.
Yes, I am sure. So you are a neurosurgeon, correct?
Yes. So yes. Not the most original storylines.
No. So what I'm curious is as a neurosurgeon, and I'm assuming that you are busy, what in the world prompted you to decide that you also wanted to be an author?
Well, one thing that makes it easier is that I put down the scalpel a couple of years ago.
Okay.
I had a neurological illness myself, and some of the leftovers left me getting things like some double vision and some clumsiness in my hands.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah. So I figured that was probably not the best idea to keep at it. But I wrote a lot. I have three nonfiction books, mostly on the subject of burnout already. And, you know, in medicine, you're constantly writing. I mean, you're writing something constantly.
Right. But the difference between writing something about burnout and creating a novel is significantly different. It's like, you know, technical writing is kind of one thing, and then a novel is like a whole nother. That's a big undertaking. So are you still doing, I know you put down the scalpel, are you still doing any kind of like consulting or meeting with patients at all? Or are you a writer full time at this point?
Well, I am not going to consider myself a full-time writer probably ever, although I am writing. But no, what I do with a lot of my time at this point is teach. So I'm teaching undergrads, I'm teaching med students in neuroscience.
All right. So I am curious, why psychological thriller? When you decided, okay, I'm putting down the scalpel, I'm picking up the pen, you know, there's a bazillion genres out there. Why psychological thriller?
First of all, I had no idea what genre this was. Hey, right. Again, I'm not in this business normally. And so when people started asking me, what's the genre? I was like, it's a novel.
It's a book.
it's fiction.
It's fiction. Yeah.
So I had to make up something, and it kind of felt like a psychological. So I kind of pitched it as a medical psychological thriller with a paranormal twist.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting about that is when I wrote my first, I also didn't write it with a genre in mind. And when they asked, I felt the same way. And they classified my first one as a historical fiction for 1970s. And that hurt my heart. It really did. It hurt my heart. So it's considered historical fiction, yet I also have to present. So it's both, and it's kind of women's fiction, and it's kind of family saga, and it's kind of, so I have the same problem where I write a story that's in my head, and then I have to figure out what category I'm going to put it in when I'm done, as opposed to some people who say, start by knowing they're going to write a cozy mystery, and that's what they do.
Let me ask you this. Have you shifted? I mean, now are you kind of framing it out in a genre at all?
No, so it's interesting. I have three books out now. They're all three considered historical fiction, but the fourth one I'm writing is not at all. And so I tell people that what I write is character-driven fiction, that I love a good character. Yeah. I love a good character. And if you love good characters and like to see them and go through what they're going through, then you'll follow my characters regardless of where I put them.
I'm going to have to write that down,
Yeah. But and it's partially I do that because I don't like being pigeonholed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if I have a good idea, I don't want to say, oh, I can't do that because I'm a historical fiction author. And though I love historical fiction and I like to read it, I have other ideas and I want to be able to pursue those. And I don't like people telling me what to do. It's left over from a lot of things in my life. And it's like, no, I'm just going to not be pigeonholed that way.
Well, this is great because you're liberating me because it really gave me a complex when.
No, and it does. You know, there's a lot of things that will do that as a writer. For instance, I'll ask you, do you plot things out or do you pants them? Do you just start writing and see where it goes?
It's a little bit of both, I guess. Okay. I mean, there's a general idea. And then once it starts taking off, it often goes where I wasn't expecting.
Right. And so I was under the impression that the only way to be a real author was to have it all plotted out. And so then I felt bad about the fact that I'm a pantser. Like I have this like vague impression of something and I start writing and my characters take over and before long they're telling me what has to happen. And if I'm not putting it down on paper, they refuse to play with me anymore and stand over against the wall and wait, you know? And so I felt like maybe I wasn't really an author. I also do not write every day. I don't like the idea of from 6 to 9 a.m. I have to sit down and write. I have to get a certain number of words. It isn't my style. And so for a long time, I felt like you did this, oh my gosh, I'm not doing it right. You know, oh no. And what liberated me was, her name is Emily Watson, I think. Oh, I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, she wrote a book called Time to Write. And in it, one of the things that she says is allow time for imagination. And I thought, you know what? My imagination is always going, even when I'm not writing. I'm writing in my head. I'm trying out scenarios. Things are going on. And it's when it finally kind of gels that it's like, oh, and then I sit down and I write. And so that liberated me. So I'm glad I was able to say something to you that let me feel like,
No, that's all great. By the way, that happens to me always in the shower. And I'm like, oh my God, I've got to write this down. Yeah.
So for me, it happens a lot when I'm walking on the beach and I've got on my phone now, I have a little app so that I can just record myself. And when I get home, you know, talk to text is not always the best. And I sometimes have to translate, what was I thinking? And then, you know, but at least it gets, gets me remembering, oh, that's right, I had that really cool idea that did whatever. So I'm curious, you know, you've got Ryan, he is your main character. He's a neurosurgeon. You are a neurosurgeon. How accurate are your descriptions of a day in the life of a neurosurgeon?
I would argue they are very accurate. It's funny. I gave the book to a med school dean because they valued her opinion. And she was reading through it and she goes, "This can't possibly be the way you guys live." And I said, "I am telling you, there is no hyperbole in this at all. I mean, that could be a step-by-step day."
And those days, as I was reading that, seem very grueling. So this idea of burnout is a real issue.
Yeah, it's definitely a real issue. It's a real issue. I think throughout medicine and frankly throughout our modern society, it's almost right. Like I was starting to feel burned out even as you're discussing this, you know, you have to write so many thousand words a day.
Because
you know, when I decided to do this, Terry, start writing fiction, I had no idea what I was doing. So I read all these books. I read, right. You know, book after book after book. And they're like, yeah, right. Stephen King's telling me I should write 20,000 words or something. And I, you know, I started feeling the same old pressure that I felt at work, where I was just like, there's not enough time in the day. I got to keep going, go, go, go. So yeah, I think we all in a modern society are overtaxed. We're multitasked. There's, you know, stuff coming at us, information coming at us nonstop from every angle. And I think you made another great point there. And another person put it in an interesting way. He said, you almost have to be bored to be creative sometimes. You know, you need enough time to let your mind wander.
You do. It's like, I don't know. I love the idea of unplugging. I have trouble with that. I like my phone. I have a lot of questions and I'll think, I wonder if, and then I Google it right away because I have my phone with me, right? I don't like wondering if I can get my answer right away. But I do like that idea of like being able to pull away and just be, because when you can do that, it's like you kind of tap into that other place, that part of your mind that simply can't create if you are busy running from A to B to C to D, E, D, E, F, G. I mean, you know, if that's what you're doing all day, you never get the chance, which is why I think that, like, I have extremely vivid dreams, extremely. Like, I wake up in the morning and think, wow, that was crazy. And part of it is my brain finally says, oh, you're quiet now? Look at all this stuff that we can, you know.
Yeah, no, I can see that. But it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of talk right now, for example, in medical school circles and residency training circles that, you know, everybody has immediate access to information so that when a question comes up in our heads, instead of actually kind of thinking it out and pulling knowledge,
we
look it up and we're not sure if, you know, what impact that's going to have on kind of medical judgment as we go along.
Oh, I hadn't considered that. Ooh, that makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, get the old doctors.
Yeah, okay. I'm going for the old ones. So let's jump back to your book for a minute. The title, how difficult was it for you to come up with a title and where did that one come from?
Yeah, you know, a good buddy of mine, Will Shakespeare, is pretty good for titles. I think I'm one of, you know, a few hundred thousand people who stole from Shakespeare. So, but I found it very apt. It's out of Romeo and Juliet. It's talking about, you know, it's Romeo thinking that Juliet is dead and commenting that, you know, she hasn't lost the blush of life in her cheeks. And therefore death hasn't hoisted its pale flag in her cheeks. And, you know, my whole book, you know, as happy as it sounds, it's a lot of death.
There is a lot of death. There's a lot of death. Yeah. But it was I'm a little concerned with thrillers. Sometimes I find them too graphic for me. This one, though graphic, it didn't feel excessive. There, the death made sense. It wasn't just gratuitous death. A lot of times, I think in a thriller, there's a lot. I think the ones I don't like more are the ones where there's just, you know, like maybe a serial killer or something where there's just lots of, you know, I don't know. I don't like that. This one didn't feel that way to me. And so, although you're right, there was a lot of death. And I'm assuming that is true with neurosurgery, that although you have a lot of patients that do well, you also have a lot of patients that do not.
Yeah, I wish I could say we have a lot of patients who do well. It's a fairly grim field when you get into the hard stuff.
Right.
You know, there is terrible car accidents, terrible head injuries, hemorrhages in the brain, strokes, brain tumors, right. You know, one thing after another. So you can get into long runs of bad tragedy. And frankly, the way the book started, originally it was going to be nonfiction because that's what I did. But I always wanted to kind of pull the curtains back a little and let people see what the real world of neurosurgery looked like. Because I think it's kind of a fantastical world in and of itself in some ways.
Right.
And so I didn't want to, you know, once it became a fiction book, I still wanted the reality to be there. What it actually looks like, what it feels like, what it feels like to have, you know, to be losing a patient on a table. And we, you know, that's used in dramatics all the time. Anytime there's a medical drama on, my God, doctor, we're losing the patient.
Right.
But so I didn't want it to come off that way. And I thank you for saying that. Hopefully it didn't, but
it didn't.
I also wanted reality.
Right. So you and I have talked, and you know, and most of my listeners know that my husband has glioblastoma.
Yeah.
And when you found that out, you quickly said, you may not want to read this. Like, it may be too much for you. And if it is, I'm fine with that. Like, it's okay. And I think we're far enough along in the journey. There wasn't anything that you said in your book that was different from what I already knew. My reality is, you know, we're very, you don't get this far. He's almost 20 months since his diagnosis, and you don't get to 20 months and not know everything. Like, you pretty much know like where your odds are, you know, everything. But it did get me to thinking, and I've been thinking about it anyway, having been on this journey as a caregiver, that being the neurosurgeon must be a very difficult job, because he had an excellent neurosurgeon who got the tumor. He did everything he was supposed to do, and it doesn't mean anything, because in the end, my husband will die of glioblastoma.
I hope and pray not, but you know, know the odds.
Yes, the odds are pretty against him, and so knowing that, I think it would be very difficult to do the job that you did, knowing you did your very best. Your very best was the best, and even so, it isn't going to make a huge difference in the end. And I think that would be like a very tough job. And it would be the same if you're working on someone maybe who's had a stroke, and that the stroke is going to be irreversible, or, you know, you went in and did everything you could, but the brain injury that they had is so severe that even if they live, they're not going to be the same. You know, that has to be a hard job.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on target. I often say, and I think this is something that very much plays into the burnout. But I think I even included it in the book. I had to get rid of 150,000 words, so sometimes I can't remember what I had in the book and what I did. But I, you know, people often think of neurosurgeons as these massive ego, you know, titans of ego.
Right.
And there is some of that behavior, but I think it's burnout behavior to be truthful. But I always say it is your ego is under assault nonstop, because there is so much we can't fix.
Right. Right. It's like, okay, here you go. You think you're big man. Look at this on your table. You know, what
exactly.
You going to do with this one? I would think that would be a very difficult. So when your book was describing the burnout portion of it, I thought, wow, I had not, like, I had been contemplating how difficult it would be, but I had not really contemplated the burnout that would be associated with that difficulty. So that was an interesting insight into, and now when I go in, like we were just at Duke a couple of days ago, and when we were there, and I'm watching, you know, his neuro-oncologist talking with us, and I'm thinking, she's got the same issue going on. She's doing her darndest. She's offering every solution she knows how, and she too understands what the odds are. You know, and that has to be hard to do that day in and day out, knowing that you are doing everything in your power, and then it may not make any difference at all.
I certainly believe so. Although I can flip it around a little. I think if, you know, it's just like everything else. If we stop and think about it for a few minutes, what an amazing privilege it is to be involved in this sort of care where, you know, I mean, it is the most, I don't know, deep and reaching situation in human experience, right? Where you're trying so hard to help others with massive struggles. And so it's just an amazing privilege. And I think if we stop and recognize that will counterbalance
a lot of our
narcissistic tendencies.
Right.
But then the other thing that it's almost magical. And people often ask me, you know, how do you do that sort of work? And I can tell you, it is the driver that got me out of bed every day. And that is not the surgery, not all the other stuff. It was the families and the patients themselves and their responses to these dreadful situations. It was almost always that they were courageous and humane and thankful. And I always resort to the term of full of grace. I don't even know how else to explain it. And so it's remarkably inspirational because you're just looking at people. And I would keep thinking, if this was me, I'd be picking up chairs and throwing them through windows and stuff. And yet, I have boxes full of thank you letters from families where I didn't do their loved one much good at all. And it's just,
right.
Counterbalancing.
I think what it boils down to is people recognize that when their loved one is in a situation that's that tough, that the people who were helping were doing everything that they could. And that as the caregiver, as the loved one, you can't ask for more than that.
Yeah.
You know, you recognize that they're doing the very best. And like in the case with my husband, the surgeon thus far has given my husband an extra 20 months that he wouldn't have had, you know. And so you have to look at it in terms of, you know, and then it's up to us. What are we going to do with that 20 months?
And, and again, my heart goes out to you, but, you know, you're exemplifying my point, you know, just so much grace and bravery in facing all this. It's just always inspirational. Always sends chills down my spine, puts tears in my eyes.
Just so that you know, though, you know, like you opened up the door to seeing the other side of neurosurgery, right? You know, like we see all of that. The other side of being where we are is that we're not always full of grace. There are days where do you see the closet behind me? That I get in that closet and I hold a pillow up to my face and I scream as loud as I can scream because I can't do this for another moment, you know? And then you say, okay. And then you start again. And I suspect it's the same with doing neurosurgery. You know, there are times where you just scream in a closet and then it's like, okay, next patient. I mean, it's just life. It's what you have to do. You know, you can either keep going forward or you can stop. There's just not any other choice, right?
Right. No, absolutely. And I think everybody is entitled to those moments.
Right. And so when people say to me things like that, like, oh, you have such grace or such courage or such strength, I think, oh, would you think that if you saw me when I wasn't? Like you're seeing me putting on my best face. You know, I'm not going to come to a podcast and be like, you know, right? And so it's like, what would you think if you saw the worst part? But I think that the truth is that everyone assumes there's that worst part. We all have it. And, you know, I'm still moving forward.
I think to answer your question, you know, if I saw that side of it, I would say, thank you.
because not perfect.
Well, because it makes me feel so inferior, you know, that people could be filled with so much grace and courage and humanity.
Yeah, no, I think,
where is mine?
No, I think that we all have, you know, there's the times where you have to put on the brave face and move forward. There's times where you really are just filled with grace. Then there's times where you're just, you know, standing and shaking your fists at God saying, what are you doing? What is this? What are you doing? And I think that's all just part of the whole journey. And really, it's part of life's journey. I don't think it's just a sickness journey. There are often times in life where we're like, what? What?
Yeah.
What? What is this? All right, let's get back to the book. Ryan sees ghosts. So do you believe in them? Have you ever seen one?
Steal someone else's verbiage when I say I with things like that, I'm what I would call a optimistic agnostic. I've never seen one. I've okay. never seen any proof of one or anything like that. But if one came in the room right now, I'd be delighted.
Okay.
You know, it would be great. I'd be like, this is fantastic. Now, I do explain that my mother and my grandmother, who, you know, I grew up with, are Scottish or were Scottish. And the Brits are much more accepting to the paranormal, I think. And they certainly were. Both of them had multiple stories of ghosts they encountered. So I was surrounded by, you know, that. Now, my dad was completely on the opposite end and would be making fun of all that.
Scoffed at the whole thing, right?
Yep.
So, you know, it's interesting. People ask me that. I love that term, by the way.
Optimistically yeah,
agnostic.
I wish it was mine.
I love that. That's boy, I'm going to use that because I had one experience that I cannot explain that felt very ghost-like, and I don't know what else to attribute it to. On the other hand, I consider myself an intellectual, and intellectuals do not believe in such silly nonsense, and yet there it was. And part of me kind of likes the idea of it. I actually go and do a writer's retreat in this old mansion that they say is haunted. And I think, oh, please, let me have one of those experiences because that would be so cool, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, but, you know, Terry, this is one of the things that actually really interests me, you know, related to the subject. And I've always been kind of interested in the dynamic between science and religion as well. I think, and I'm in neuroscience. So in neuroscience, we just basically explain everything because the brain can do that. You know, anything
we see
and experience. Yeah, well, of course, the brain can do that. That's what the brain does. But I often am kind of shocked at the level of hubris of the science side when they just completely come in and sweep it all away and say, this is all impossible. This can't be, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you can't, there's
How
no
do you
proof
know
of that.
That.
How yeah. you got, you know, talk about open minds. You think you're, you know, you think you're so sweeping in your cognitive expanse. And then all of a sudden you shut it down the minute something like that is called into question. So I'm kind of like you. I love the idea. It would be a blast. Number
I think
one,
it would be, yeah. As long as they're friendly, I think it would be pretty cool.
Even if they're unfriendly,
I'm a little more fearful of unfriendly, but yeah, I mean, I think it would be an interesting, I don't know. It's like, especially with science and you know, I'm all for science, you know, definitely. And yet I know that science is not the end all because it changes because we learn new things.
Exactly.
So what was scientifically true 50 years ago is not necessarily scientifically true today. I learned things in school that were facts that are not facts anymore. And so science isn't quite the end all that people often allude to. Oh, follow the science. And it's like, okay, so what we're doing is following today's understanding of the way the world works.
Exactly. And science really, in its purest form, is based on skepticism. It's always calling into question the dogma, and it never actually proves anything to, you know, zero doubt, zero question.
Right.
The minute you do that, it is dogma. And so,
and that means you have to be questioning it. I mean,
exactly.
Right. So yeah, I like that. The experience that I had was really very interesting. It was I had a great uncle that I didn't know super well, but he was a wonderful man, loved my kids. He passed away. We went to his funeral and I saw him sitting in a chair next to his casket. I saw him sitting there and I'm looking around at everyone else to see if they see him, you know, no one else seems to be the least bit concerned. He kind of nodded at me and I was like, what? And so then you go back and you say, okay, was I overtired? Was I overwrought? What was that? And in my mind, I know what I saw. I know what I saw, and yet I have no way to prove it because no one else saw it. And could it be my imagination? I guess it could be. I remember seeing Santa Claus once when I was six, and he was in our living room putting presents under the tree, and I know that wasn't true. I remember seeing it, so it could be that same thing happening, or it could be something else.
Yeah, you know? And, you know, 100%. And it's a great story, by the way. Definitely sends chills down the spine. And again, I love that stuff anyway. But you know, the neuroscientist side of it would say, oh, yeah, you know, our brain can create anything. Just think of every dream that you have. But also, you know, our brains are very suggestible, and you can, you know, start seeing things ostensibly just out of the power of suggestion, or not see things. And so here you are at a funeral and, you know, all sorts of memories. Well,
and you're having the memories through. And the other things. And he was dressed the way he would have been dressed sitting at home. And it was just, And so, like you said, it was an overactive imagination. You know, was my brain just doing its thing, or was he there? And how would you ever prove it? You know?
And so I'll give you a little example though of kind of the scientific side's failings on things like this, or to me, they just keep drifting into the same lanes that, you know, the believers are. So I don't know if you saw, but in the last, a few months ago, a bunch of articles came out and it hit the lay press that they had somebody put out a study where they had a bunch of EEGs going while people died in the hospital. They were getting brain recordings during the actual time of death. And all of a sudden there was just after death, after the heart stopped, there was all this electrical activity going on in the brain. And when they analyzed it, they said, this is very similar to the waking brain, to a brain really engaged with the environment. So all of a sudden they're coming to the conclusion, oh, this explains everything now about these near-death experiences, you know, the bright white channel and your family waving you to come along and stuff. There, you see, we've explained it. Now we don't have to deal with that BS anymore because it's just this extra electrical activity going on.
Your brain died slower than your heart did.
I'm going, wait a minute, guys, this doesn't explain anything. You don't know what that electric, it could just be like the fuzz on a TV, you know, when it's gone blank. And we have no idea what was actually going on in these people's minds.
Well, and so, not only that, but they could have actually been capturing them seeing the white light.
Yeah, I mean,
how do you know that you weren't actually seeing them waving to their family? Like, exactly. How do you know?
So that's where, you know, again, I think these leaps of faith that people in religion and, you know, in kind of the paranormal world make fairly readily, and the scientists kind of scoff at, and then all of a sudden the scientists kind of turn around and make a leap of faith themselves. And so I just keep thinking the two poles aren't that far apart.
I don't think they're that far apart. I really don't. I think that there isn't any reason why you can't be a religious scientist. Like, I think that they're both trying to explain the same phenomena, and they're both coming maybe from some different angles, but isn't that what science does anyway, or should do? Right. I mean, shouldn't you be looking at this from as many different angles as you can? Because if you can, then you will understand it better. If you only look at something from one angle, it's like that poem about the blind men who are describing an elephant, but each one touches a different thing. So they're touching either the trunk or the knee or the tail or the tusk. And what they're describing is totally different. And yet they're all touching an elephant. And so if you only saw an elephant's knee, what you think of an elephant is different.
Yeah. I think that's a great metaphor. I think we do it all the time. And the other thing I try to get across is we're doing all this with an imperfect machine. You know, our brains are amazing. Right. They're miraculous. They're crazy what they are capable of. And yet it filters out a huge amount of data coming at us all the time.
Oh yeah. Because there's no way we can. And we say filters it out. It filters it out for what we are able to express, but we don't know where the rest of that data goes.
Right.
Or what our brains are doing with it, you know, because, and I'm unsure of like percentage anymore, but there's a good portion of our brain that we still don't know what it actually is doing most of the day. Is that correct? Like, there's things that we don't really understand about how the brain still works.
Oh, there's tons and tons of stuff that we don't actually get. You know, we have a much better appreciation for it. But when you get to you just think about it, all it is a bunch of Morse code. It's not even any dashes. It's all dots. You know, it's binary code almost, dot, 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 going through these, through 80 billion neurons, and they're all going at once. And how does that all of a sudden turn into all that we have? I'm still not sure. And we can make it up as we go along. But I think there's so much unaccounted for. And plus, our brains are designed to kind of tell us stories. It creates the universe around us with what it's able to take in.
Right.
But it's telling us a story, and it's a story that allows us to function in whatever our reality is. But it is not giving us a one-to-one representation of reality.
Which you can tell, for instance, years and years ago, I was a bank teller, and we went through a training where they had a robber come in and demand money. And then the police, not real bad, but they came and they questioned the four tellers standing there. And it was amazing what some people saw that others did not. We all saw the same thing. He was there in the room. He only did one thing. Like, he didn't do four different things for four different tellers. And yet people saw him as different heights. People heard different accents. People didn't even know he spoke. Like, there was one woman who said, no, he didn't say a word. He just came in, you know, and there was another woman who like was able to tell you every word that he said. And why? I mean, we all saw the very same thing, but like you said, it's, what are you focused on? What is your brain focusing on? What does your brain think that you need in this situation?
Yeah. How does it fit into your brain's story of everything?
Of what's going on here,
And you must have experienced this. This is something I never knew about until, I started reading about it in these How Do You Write Fiction books and stuff. You must be familiar with the concept, though, and seen it. But I think this is one of the more fascinating aspects of doing this, putting the books out, fun aspects of it. And that is, people have told me that once you put the book out, it's not yours anymore. Your motivations, your thoughts, your why the character does this and that, it doesn't mean anything.
No, it's the readers. Yeah. In fact, sometimes they'll say to me, oh, I love this part because, and they start explaining like why my character did this. And I'm thinking, wow. That's why he did that.
Exactly.
I have no clue.
I often go, yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Wow. You're right.
Write
that sounds
down
much
to
better
remember.
Than my motivation.
Yeah. Write it down so that when the next person asks you, you have something cool to say. Exactly. Yeah, it is true. And I think it's the same reason why you can read a book and not like it, and then read a book 10 years later and think it's one of the best books you've ever read. And it has to do with like where you are, what's going on in your life, what your experience is now, those kinds of things that give you a different insight into the book and now you like it. Or just the opposite, a book that you remember loving and you go to reread and you think, why did I even like this book? And it has to do with, like you said, what parts are you taking in and what does it mean to you at that moment?
Yeah. If you want to go to neuroscience on this one, because I think this is one of the more inspirational and fascinating components of neuroscience to me, is you can in some ways imagine why this is true and why we all come at things from different perspectives and all. And that is, our brains are laid out in a certain way, a certain architecture, a certain wiring diagrams, if you will. And I think people tend to see our brains like a computer, it's all set up, all the wires are set up. But yes, we're put out of the factory that way. And then for our entire lives, everything we do, everything we experience, everything we hear, see, feel, touch, think, changes the wiring diagrams.
Yeah.
The big wires are still about the same. But when you get down to the microscopic level and individual nerves and that sort of thing, they are constantly in flux, constantly changing, constantly influenced by your environment, your thoughts, all that sort of thing. So to think that any of us are going to think the exact same way or to experience reality the exact same way or to tell ourselves the same story, the exact same way is crazy because our brains are shifting and changing. And so it gets back to what you're saying. We don't have the same brain we had 10 years ago.
No. And not only do we not have the same brain 10 years ago, but even a year from now, our brain will be significantly different. And then I look at it in terms, so my husband has had a couple of little mini strokes, probably due to the radiation. And because of where his tumor was, he has a lot of speech difficulty. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much gotten past that, where he was almost back to his fluent self. And then he had a little stroke in that area and it has just knocked it backwards again. And it's amazing though, how something came in and disrupted. And so his brain said, oh, well, we're going to have to find another path to get those words out. And just and is in there creating a whole new pathway.
Yeah.
And you watch people who get past brain injury of any kind and you see them go from, maybe their right side is weak and they're having trouble walking to being able to go out and walk, maybe with a cane, but still now they're walking where they weren't able to, or they're talking and they weren't able to, the brain is amazing with its ability to just fix itself.
To a degree, and I guess another nice example of it, a really fascinating example, are these things where situations where they've placed electrodes on the brain or in the brain and trained people to move robotic arms just by thinking about
it.
Yes. Well, that area of the brain was not able to do that a priori, you know, right at that time. The brain had to figure it out and adjust the signaling and all that sort of thing. It's crazy.
It is. I think that the brain, I think that as we find more, and we're going to find more and more. I think that there's a whole lot about the brain that we still have no clue about at all. And even things like, and in my book, Daughters of Green Mountain Gap, I talk a lot about the kind of almost the magical aspect of medicine, the idea that, you know, you believe you can get well, so you do. Mm-hmm. You know, and there is a lot of that that is not really explainable by science. Optimistic people usually heal from surgeries faster. Why is that? There shouldn't be that. The belief that someone can heal you so they can, even though they might not have those skills to do so, but you believe that them saying the words or laying their hand on your head or whatever it is will be the thing that cures you, and you're cured. The people who take pills for pain that are just sugar pills, and yet mm-hmm. their pain goes away. Something is going on in our brains that I don't think that we've yet come close to explaining.
No, we know the phenomena for sure, and there is good evidence that, you know, things like placebo have significant effects even on overall health, and as you're saying, you know, recovery from oncology and all that sort of thing. And you know, you can make it up. I do a lot of making it up, you know, when I'm talking to the students and all, because you can kind of create a scenario, because the brain is wired into everything, right? It either can do it through hormones, or it can do it directly through electrical signaling through the vagus nerve and stuff like that, that you can alter the function of all the organs in your body one way or the other from above. But how we do it, that's another question.
It's the how, I think, that is so interesting, that I don't think we have enough technology now to see that it is happening. Mm-hmm. We can measure that it is happening. We got the EEGs, and you can go in there and you can say, see, when we do this, this happens. But the how is the thing that is so crazy to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, when Bruce's neurosurgeon was going to take the tumor out, he said, because of where it is potential that he could lose speech, and it's potential that we won't get it back. And he said, and I can't know that, because I can't look. There's, when I open him up, there's not like little tags.
Not labeled.
Yeah. No. That say, don't touch here. this is where I'm speaking. And he said, you know, so my husband actually did the awake craniotomy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he remembers, he said, I remember that they were showing me the flashcards and they were talking to me and I started to get slow. And he said it got more labored and slow. And the man showing me the flashcards signaled to the doctor and they were done. That was as much as they were going to do. And first of all, that's crazy. The fact that he could be awake and have surgery going on, just still, I can hardly contemplate it. And it almost creeps me out a little. But the fact that you can't know. It's not like you say, okay, there's the brain and I can't cut here, 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 and here, because you have a general idea. We're in the speech area, but you don't know where your knife goes, what it's actually going to sever. Like, you know what I mean? Maybe like you said, maybe the main branches, but not all the little ones.
Yeah, no, it absolutely. And let me tell you, I date back to where it was even much more kind of on the edge. Now we have all these tools in the operating rooms that we call neuronavigation, and you can, you know, you do the awake craniotomies, you can do neurostimulation, and I mean, we got all sorts of, we have ways of making the tumors glow and you can see it better and all this sort of stuff. But You know, back in the day, there was a lot of dead reckoning going on too. And you're just going, I think it's pretty much around here. And, and that sort of thing. So yeah, you were definitely, you felt a lot more naked in the minefield than,
I'm sure. I'm sure. And even now, there's still a lot of, you know, we'll see what happens when we're done.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen operations even when it's done awake. You know, everything seems good. Usually, you put the person to sleep then when you're closing,
right? Right.
And I've seen it where people have woken up and have new deficits, and so there's no guarantee even with the awake surgery.
Right. Right. So this is an interesting story. When they put my husband back to sleep to do the closing, and they were putting the, I guess, some screws in to hold, he heard the drilling. He heard whoever was drilling say, shit, this isn't going to hold. I need to put in a new one. And then he heard the anesthesiologist say, he's awake. And then he wasn't awake anymore. And that was the
Yeah.
And I said, did that, that would have terrified me. And he said, no, I thought it was really cool.
You don't want to hear your surgeon say
no,
shit.
No, but he said he didn't feel like it was a scary thing. It was more like this isn't going to hold. I'm going to have to put a different one in, you know, that kind of thing. But it was, he said, no, it didn't bother him at all. And I thought, I am so glad that wasn't me, because I would have been thinking, I'm awake. I'm awake. You don't know I'm awake.
Yeah, no, there's, you know, and the poor anesthesiologists there, you know, all of us, all fields of medicine have complications they dread.
Right.
And one of the ones in anesthesia traditionally has been to have a patient awake, even though all the indicators are they're asleep.
Right.
And it happens with, you know, it's rare, but it happens with enough frequency. I've seen it a few times. I had a patient once, it was way back in the Army. We were doing a neck operation. We have him upright. He was upright, head kind of in a vice. And he comes out of surgery. It all went well, but he came out of surgery and he said, you know, doc, I could remember every bit of the operation. I'm like, oh yeah, sure. You know, patting him on the head. And yeah, we often have these dreams. And he starts recalling our whole conversation. And I was like, oh my gosh, you really were. And then I'm thinking, I hope you were ultra professional today, which thankfully
you didn't were. Say something crazy, right?
Right. Yeah. And he said, no, you guys were great. And I could hear you talking to the resident, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, I'm so sorry. That must have hurt. And he said, no, you know, actually, most of the time I didn't feel any pain. There was one time where I started getting pain down my arm. And you said to the resident, don't pull on that so hard. So, it's just crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
Yes. And he said, you know, I was trying to signal to you guys I was awake, but there's paralyzing agents that you're given, so they can't move. So he said, I'm trying to change my heart rate so you guys figure it out. But we didn't.
Isn't so crazy. Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, there's a lot to medicine that is not readily apparent to the average person who's walking around. That's for sure. Is Ryan, is that you? Is that someone you know? Is it a combination of neurosurgeons? Where did Ryan come from?
I would have to think so. I mean, there's obviously autobiographical.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's true of any, I think it's true of any writer, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I because it's your thoughts, right? You know, it's really hard to kind of put yourself completely into someone else. So my stock answer is that, you know, all the bad stuff, all his bad characteristics are definitely mine.
Definitely.
I was so, you know, I so lucky in my career to work with just a lot of fantastic people. And particularly back in my Army days, I worked with a lot of neurosurgeons who, interestingly enough, most of them came out of West Point. And you know, talk about feeling inferior over, you know, your behavior and stuff. I mean, they just they're stunning. What amazing people they are. So, you know, any good parts is probably an amalgam of those guys.
I see. Okay. Other than a good story, what do you hope a reader walks away with after reading Death's Pale Flag?
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Truly. Thank you for asking that. I do hope it's a good story. I hope there's thrills and chills. I hope the spooky, and people tell me the spooky side is kind of spooky and gave them, you know, some scares. So I'm glad about that. I wanted the reader to actually think about what's actually scarier, the ghosts or the real world.
Right. Right.
But I think, a few drivers there. One of the biggest ones is just to get a peek behind the curtains, hopefully in an immersive fashion where you feel yourself at the operation, you know, and trying to maybe even think about how you would talk to a patient and all that sort of thing. And I really, really did want to get across the grace, the humanity, the bravery of the patients. And then I guess one of the things I really wanted to get across as well is just how fragile it all is. Just how easy we go from everything. And, you know this, Terry.
Yeah, everything is fine one moment and then it's not.
These, you know, I've always worked in these big medical centers and their trauma centers and all that sort of thing. And we lived real close to the hospital there at Virginia Tech, but the helicopters are coming over. It feels like nonstop. And, you know, you get this complex that every one of them has a neurosurgical disaster on them. And right. I am not going to get sleep tonight. But then when you stop and you think of it, everyone is bringing in somebody whose life, whose family's life is just disrupted in an instant. Not disrupted. Shredded, torn apart.
Changed completely from what you always knew to something new, and it's not pretty.
A whole different universe. I think if I could get anything across, it's to kind of savor the mundane, we live wonderful lives, and why not savor it? These things happen to us. Hopefully we make the best of those situations as well, but we might as well really soak up and enjoy what we have.
I agree. I tell people all the time that Bruce and I right now are not any different than anyone else. He has a clock over his head. So does every other person you know.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is that someone has pointed out the clock to us.
Yeah.
You know, we now know it's there. We can't avoid it. It is what is running right now. And
you hear it ticking, but
everyone has that. Absolutely everyone. Because the day before we knew that Bruce had brain cancer was like any other day we had ever had. Mm-hmm. There was no problem. He had no problems. In fact, the first problem we had, we thought he was having a stroke. And what it turned out to be was a brain tumor pressing and causing speech issues that looked very stroke-like.
Yeah.
And the next day, so we get to the hospital, he's fine now. I mean, it happened and then it went away. And we were at the hospital and they said it was probably just a TIA. They were giving us who we're going to go see and, you know, da, 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 da. And, you know, they're going to run, you know, just a couple more little tests and we'll go home tomorrow. And when tomorrow came and we got a neurology consult and we were told that he had a tumor, I remember thinking, what? A what? And then I heard the word oncologist and my mind immediately went to cancer? What? I thought stroke. It was a cancer. And then I didn't hear anything else.
Yeah.
Like
yes.
I'm watching the mouth move, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm standing there and like, I can't hear. I can't think. I can't do anything. And what kept going through my mind was I had taken the whole day before to do this art. I took this art class. I'm not an artist. Okay, so this was just like a thing. And I kept thinking in my head, what a waste. What a waste. My husband has brain cancer and I was off doing an art project. Like, I couldn't wrap my mind around doing something so mundane. It was like, how stupid was that? I should have done, I don't know what I thought I should have done, but like there had to have been something I should have been doing that was more important than that art project, you know? And so it is that kind of crazy thing. And I tell people all the time, do what it is you want to do. Do it now. You don't know what tomorrow is.
And savor it.
Yeah. And I hate bucket lists.
Yeah. You know, me too. I don't
to me, a bucket that. List should be a to-do list that you're planning to get done in a reasonable amount of time. I have a yearly list of things I hope to get accomplished. But in terms of bucket lists, if it is a bucket list and you're not planning to do it right now, throw it out.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
You know, go do it. Either go do it or get it off the list. It's just... You know?
Yeah, you know, we all have to do our ADLs, activities right. of daily living. We have to, you know, make enough money to survive right. and all that sort of thing. And even there, again, you know, this runs into the burnout world as well, because our way of tackling burnout is to build our resilience, to build a better resilience against it. And some of it is learning to enjoy the day. And, right. and every day, right. Yes, there are frustrations, yes, there are the things that you're going to have to overcome and all that. But, you know, we're given this amazing world, this amazing universe where there's just so much to savor. And we're given each other, you know, we're given, you know, friends, family,
right.
people.
I
guess that's another thing that that really has impressed me. You know, in the career is like right now, politically, we seem to be at each other's throats. We're so nasty and say such, me included, say such nasty things. And yet I guarantee if I drive anywhere in the United States and my car breaks down, I'm there by the side of the road, people are going to stop.
And they are. And I know this, my husband and I actually took a tandem bicycle ride and rode from the coast of Oregon to Washington, D.C.
Oh my gosh.
Of 2020, 3,102
wow.
miles. Okay. So we rode across the United States. Now this was COVID summer, political unrest summer. It was, everyone said we were crazy. We shouldn't do it. And do you know what we found? Wonderful people across
yeah.
the United States.
We
didn't run into anybody. There were a couple of people on the road who'd do things like throw their middle finger out the window at us when we were riding because they had to go around us or something like that. But generally, people were friendly. When we needed help, we got help. When we had a flat tire and people were there, it was amazing to me. It restored my just how humanity is, my faith. Like,
yeah.
like people are generally good. And it didn't matter what they believed. Nobody once while we were on the trip asked me what my religion was or my political affiliation, nothing, because it didn't matter, because that's not what was mattering at the time. And I think that that's true, that I would love for people to maybe like turn off the news for a while
yeah.
and go and chat with your neighbor.
Yeah. And
just enjoy
it. We're
yeah.
social animals. You know, we really should be out there more. We should be enjoying each other.
We should be on
more.
Our front porch and chatting and waving at the neighbors. And, you know,
right.
I think that life would be a whole lot less stressful if we connected again.
Put front you know? Porches on the houses
yeah.
again, right?
Yeah.
I agree. And so again, to me, those are the things that we need to be savoring. I don't
right.
need a lot of trips to Paris, to be frank. You know, it's fun,
right.
I guess, but you know, just to enjoy each other. And again, it's not casting aspersions. People should do what brings them pleasure, but they
right.
should really, really savor it and say, yeah, this is great.
This is well, and to be able to find pleasure in the mundane, to be mm-hmm. able to look and say, you know, this was a good day. Well, why? What did you do today? I enjoyed my husband and I had a fabulous conversation. You know,
Terry,
like,
that reminds me. I you know, after working for decades in neurosurgery, and the hours are long and hard. I mean, you go in, there's whole months where I've never seen the sun,
right,
type of thing. And I a couple of years ago, when I first kind of surfaced out of that, I'm going for a walk with my wife, and I'm looking around and I'm going, good God, the bird song is deafening. It's crazy. Is this something crazy going on? Yeah.
Right?
She's like, no, it's spring. She goes, it's like this all the time. I go, you're kidding. And she goes, no. I go, it's beautiful. And she goes, yeah. And I mean, literally, and I had no idea. And so there it is, you know, the simplest of things.
Right.
That can bring you so much joy, so much pleasure, if you just kind of stop and listen or look or whatever.
I agree. So what's next, Gary?
I'm in the finishing touches of here we go with genre, but I think this definitely fits the YA category.
Okay.
So it's a total shift in gears. I'm a little bit on a quest. I worry about American men of all people, men after being, you know, these dominant bullies for how many millennia, are really falling behind. I mean, I teach in college, and you know, the girls are kicking the guys' butts, and which is great. I mean, it's all wonderful, the advances of women, but there's this part of me that worries about idle men. You know, men are a little bit more, not even a little bit, a lot more tending towards violence, and idle men seem to be able to get in a lot of trouble. And I'm not going to change anything, I guess, but I would love to get more guys reading, especially young men.
Yep,
and
youth,
so
right.
I thought I'd try a crack at a story that maybe young men might enjoy. It's kind of sports oriented and stuff, but there's romance, so hopefully girls would like it too. But and that sounded very gender specific, by the way, but I don't mean it that way.
But that's what happens as an author, as you're trying to determine who am I writing for.
Yeah.
You know, you do tend to like really narrow it down, and then you're like, oh, but let's open it back up again. Yes. I don't want just males between the ages of 15 and 20 reading this. Let's see, you know, and yeah, but I do the same thing, because I would say that my books are aimed generally at women, but I've had a lot of men read them and like them. So obviously they're not just aimed at women, but like when I'm writing them, that's who I have in mind.
Yeah.
But I don't like
stereotyping too much,
neither,
I guess.
Neither do I, but I think it's perfectly acceptable to say that you had young adult men in mind when writing your book.
Yeah. And we raised three boys. I say we, my wife did. She was
you were there
mom.
On occasion in the evenings, right?
Yeah.
Some evenings.
I was there to disrupt all the orders she had restored, which is a lot when you have three boys. But, you know, it just strikes. And so they grew up surrounded by books and reading and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And I think it gave them such a leg up. So, I mean, if we can get more boys reading, more power to us, because hopefully it will keep a calmer society.
I agree. So when do you hope this new one will be out? What kind of...
Well, I thought I was done.
We always think we're done.
As, you know, kind of a developmental editor type took a look at it and said, my God, how did you come up with so many adverbs? And you know, then he wanted me to, I don't know, shift into deep third person. And I'm like, oh Lord, now I have to look that up that sort of thing. But so I'm playing with it again, but I'll probably be done in another month or two.
Fantastic. How can people get in touch with you if they want to know more about Gary Simmons, Death's Pale Flag, your new book coming out?
Thanks for asking. And you know, it is one of my goals in all this is just to connect with people and discuss the type of topics you and I are discussing today. And boy, you know, we can go down that rabbit hole pretty deep if we want.
Yeah.
So I have a website, and it's just my name, GaryRSimmons.com.
Okay.
It's Simmons, S-I-M-O-N-D-S, You can pronounce it Simons. You can pronounce
it
idiot.
Any way you want to,
if
right?
If you want, right.
All right.
Wonderful. So, yeah, very much thanks for asking me.
I'll have that in the show notes so that people will be able to look you up and reach out to you if they'd like. I definitely recommend the book. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And well, Gary, I want to thank you so much for being here with me today. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure. The time has flown by.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch. Tune in next Tuesday for another podcast episode.